So this evening I want to talk about the second part of the fourth noble truth, wholesome speech, wise action, and conscious livelihood. It's interesting that after we have begun to have right understanding and formed an intention to act on this understanding, the Buddha then chooses to talk about how we act in the world before he talks about meditative practice. He seems to be saying that how we live in the world, in our daily lives, is as important as more formal practice. One of my teachers on retreat said that we often have things backwards on retreat. We think sitting is most important, then walking practice, and then routine daily things like eating and showering, etc. We need to reverse this order of priorities. It's also true that if we act mindfully in our daily life, our conscience will be clear and our mind less clouded with thoughts of remorse, which of course helps us when we're sitting. So these three parts of living in the world, first one is wholesome speech. And it's interesting that the Buddha speaks so much about speech in his teaching. There's another teaching called the 10 Forms of Unwholesome Action, Speech and Thought. In that list of 10, four of the 10 are regarding speech and various parts of how we speak. And I think that's it's a useful way to talk about wholesome speech is to look at these four things. First one is just not telling the truth. It's difficult to deal with this because often we think, well, I can tell this, I can stretch this little truth a little bit, or I can, tell that little white lie to protect somebody. Often what we're doing is avoiding things when we do this, or we're trying to make ourselves look better. Both of these are unwholesome actions of speech. And also, sometimes we're just, we're lying to get someone in trouble, in the extreme case, and that's obviously unwholesome speech. The next of these four is harsh speech. This is an interesting one because, part of our culture is like, well, if I really want to get someplace, I have to sort of be pushy. I have to push a little harder, and sometimes that requires that I speak harshly. I've been guilty of this myself in my life. You're talking to some person on the phone, some service person, and you're not getting what you want, or it's not getting where you want it to get. And my tendency has been to just bark, to say, I want to speak to your supervisor, blah, blah, blah. Be pushy. And this is not wholesome. It's not, it makes the other person feel uncomfortable. And in the end, I always sort of feel icky afterwards. It's you can I can I see how it doesn't work. And at the same time, it's so tempting because it's a way of getting what you want. And then the third of these list of four is gossip. Gossip is always harmful. Gossip is this way where we try and make ourselves feel important by, I know something you don't know, and I'm going to share it with you because I think you're so special. It's a way of making ourselves feel good by pushing down somebody else and by showing off how wonderful we are. This is, once again, not wholesome. This is a way of harming others. I mean, very directly harming others. And then the last of these four, and the one I actually kind of like that the Buddha added this into the list, is useless speech. Just plain old babble. It's often what we do when, we're with people we don't know, we're a bit uncomfortable with, perhaps, or we're just in a group of people and there's sort of this empty space in the conversation, and we feel like, oh, we got to say something, right? So we just sort of blurt out something, or we start say something totally useless. We can't just sit there and be quiet. Often this is when we say things that are inappropriate and unskillful. And I think if we actually looked at how much we say every day, we can probably take about 50% of it out and everything would be just fine. There was a teacher once who told me that if I just wrote down every time I said something, I made notes about it afterwards, all the things I said, and then looked at it at the end of the day, I'd be shocked at how much of what I said was totally useless. Didn't serve any purpose other than just to fill in the space. This isn't, however, to say that we shouldn't at times speak in ways that are purely social. We have to sort of be polite. We have to, live in a social world. So we can't ignore that. We can't pretend that's not true. But we have to be careful that we don't use that as an excuse just to babble. So it's a fine balance of this. So the interesting thing about holding speeches, as I've just expressed it, is that it all sounds kind of negative. Don't do this, don't do that. Sort of energy. There is, however, this great quote from the Buddha that I think expresses it in what I'll call positive terms. Bhikkhus, possessing five factors, speech is well spoken, not badly spoken. It is blameless and beyond reproach by the wise. What five? It is spoken at the proper time. What is said is true. It is spoken gently. What is said is beneficial. It is spoken with a mind of loving kindness. I like this way of putting it because like I said, it puts it in positive terms, but it also, there's a sort of a sweetness to it. And when you think about if everything we said met all five of those criteria, if we were, before we said something, we'd pause and go, were all those things true? Is it really beneficial? Am I speaking out of a place of loving kindness? Is it the right time? I mean, sometimes, yes, something has to be said, but it's like the other person isn't, you can see the other person isn't going to be receptive, so why bother saying it? So it's like it's a good set of criteria. Is it spoken at the proper time? What is said is true. Is it spoken gently? What is said is beneficial. It is spoken with a mind of loving kindness. So it's a good reflection on how to speak and how to not to speak. Probably the not to speak is probably as important as how to speak. So that's wholesome speech. The next of the steps on the Eightfold Path, wise action. That's how we, so we've got past speech, and now often speech turns into action. So how is it that we can act skillfully? How can we act wisely in our moving about in the world, in our daily life? This is usually expressed in terms of what are called the five precepts. These were the initial vows that monks took and nuns took when they joined the Sangha. But they're also what we, the five vows that people take when they go on retreat often. So here's the five precepts. Non-harming, taking only what is offered, correct speech, refraining from sexual misconduct, and not abusing alcohol and drugs that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. So let's look at these. Non-harming. Well, obviously that means not physically harming. It sometimes is written as not killing, but I think it's much more than that. especially if we start looking at this from a broader context, where there's a whole movement in the Buddhist world these days around ecological issues. So if I change the oil on my car and then take the oil and dump it down the storm drain, which I know ends up in the creek, I'm harming others. And I have to like think about that and go, oh, that's not a skillful thing to do. Just as if I'm on a larger scale, I own a factory and I dump stuff in the local water table and harm many people. That's harming. It isn't directly, whacking people with a stick sort of harming, but it's definitely harmful. So we have to start looking at everything in our lives and saying, is this harming other people or am I acting skillfully here? Taking only what is offered. On retreat and in the life of a bhikkhu, this means not taking anything that isn't actually consciously offered to you. So when the monks went on their rounds to get alms, they would walk with their bowl in front of them, with their eyes downcast, and then people would come and put food in their bowl. So it's only what is offered. Once again, though, I think this, because we're not going to wander around, at least I'm not going to wander around with a begging bowl in Boulder, is probably not going to work too well. What does this mean in the larger context? It's like, I think this has to do with not having too much stuff, not having to always get more things, taking more than the planet can sustain. We all have things we like, and it's not like we shouldn't have stuff. I work as a carpenter and I need tools to do the job I do, and so I have a collection of tools. Nothing wrong with that at all. It's just that I have to be careful that I don't sort of wander through the tool department at Home Depot and go, ooh, look at that one, and want to get another one that I don't really need at all. This is harmful to the world. So it's like starting to look at all the stuff we have, whether it's tools in my case, or clothes, or vehicles, or whatever, and consciously going, do I really need to have that much stuff? That's what taking only what is offered means in the context of us householder life. The third of these precepts is correct speech. Well, I've already spent a lot of time talking about that. The interesting thing is on retreat, when correct speech actually means noble silence. It means consciously choosing not to talk at all. Now we're not, on our daily life, we're not on retreat, but this is like, it might be an interesting experiment. Can you take half a day, Sunday morning sometime, and say, I'm not going to speak for the next 4 hours and see what that's like. That means, and remember, speech is more than like verbal blah blah. It means, oh, wait, no reading, no writing, which means no internet, no checking email messages on my phone. Like, step away from words completely. It's very powerful. It's like our mind shifts when we do this, when we actually practice noble silence. Even in our daily lives, we can choose to do this as much as we can. Fourth of these, refraining from sexual misconduct. This is a touchy subject, but I want to put it in the context of the other precepts, because that's where it makes sense. The Buddha wasn't trying to enforce some sort of morality. There's nothing here about only between a man and a woman. There's nothing here about only between two people, for that matter, or only with the man on top to make babies. None of that is here at all. when we're talking about sexual misconduct, we're talking about not harming, taking only what is offered, correct speech. Well, I'm not going to, do I, would I feel comfortable if someone asked me, did this happen? Would I have to lie? Or the flip side of that is, am I going to gossip about it later, like, whoa, and show off how great I am? These are both, that would be sexual misconduct. And then it also relates very directly to the last of the five precepts, not abusing alcohol and drugs that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. So sexual misconduct in this context is this person I'm with intoxicated? Are they high? Am I intoxicated or high? Can I make a correct and wholesome decision in that situation? Or can my this person I'm about to do something with do that? Changes how we start to look at those sort of things by consciously going, man, maybe I should not do this. It's not skillful. The last one, as I read it, the fifth of these is, not abusing alcohol and drugs that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. I want to point something out here. The actual traditional way of saying this is abstaining from alcohol and drugs that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. But I would be hypocritical telling you to restrain, since I actually enjoy a beer or a glass of wine with a meal sometimes. And so this is a very this is where the precepts start to be personal in a sense. We have to look at them within the context of our lives and go, does this how does this make sense for me? And for me, the thing is, one, I can have a beer or a glass of wine and it seems fine to me. I enjoy it. It's sort of part of being social. I like the taste. And one is fine. It's when I have more than one that I turn into someone stupid, basically. And I haven't done that in a very long time. I think probably 35 years or so since I had more than one, when I let myself get stupid, essentially. And so this is where we have to sort of see where our edges are. For many people, having even one is a dangerous thing to do. For my metabolism, it seems to be fine. One seems to be fine. This is a personal decision. But I don't want to, wag a finger here. Find what works for you. Interesting thing is that all of these things, all of these precepts, aren't based on morality. There's no wagging finger here in any place. This is like, here's criteria, here's the way to look at things. Now, figure out how that applies to your life, to what, how you live and what you do on a daily basis. Joseph Goldstein has a great thing he says about this on his book Mindfulness. So much of what the Buddha taught seems so obvious. Don't kill, don't steal, don't harm. Still, as we try to apply and practice this in our lives, we can come to the forward edge of our understanding and commitment. And this edge can be a challenging place to be. One teacher commented that practicing the precepts doesn't make us uncomfortable. It's probably a sign that we should investigate them more deeply. I find that really, really interesting. If we don't feel a little uncomfortable, maybe we're not looking deep enough. I appreciate this comment because it points to these steps on the path as actual practices, things to understand and investigate in our lives, rather than taking it for granted that we're basically good people and then looking no further. The key here is these are practices. These are things that we actually have to pay attention to and practice. And it also, it's in, what's implied there, of course, is practices mean that sometimes we're not going to succeed. Sometimes we're going to mess up. Sometimes we're not going to be perfect. So we don't want to try and force ourselves. We don't want to try and overdo this and make ourselves perfect. That's not the intent here. The intent is to practice these and apply these principles that the five precepts lay out to our lives as best we can. The Buddha emphasized this in a verse in the Majjhima Nikaya, in a thing called the Salika Sutta. And this is verse 13 of this sutta. And in this sutta, the Buddha is basically laying out to a disciple named Kunda what it means to lead a wholesome life. Kunda, I say that even the inclination of mind towards wholesome states is of great benefit. So what should be said of bodily and verbal acts conforming to such states of mind? So even setting the intention, and we are back in right intention, you know, the second step in the Eightfold Path, setting the intention and having that thought in the mind, even that is wholesome and useful. And actually then conforming to that intention is even stronger. But it's like where it starts with just setting the intention and then seeing how we can practice these precepts in our daily lives. What's important is that we avoid the tendency to beat ourselves up, to blame ourselves, to go, oh, you know, I'm not good enough, I'm not perfect enough, I'm not pure enough. This is unwholesome thought. This is not skillful. We have to actually accept the fact that we're somewhat less than perfect human beings, and then try and, as we see that we sometimes are acting less than perfectly, try to make sure we don't do that again. It's quite simple, really. The last of these lifestyle, I suppose, call them steps on the Eightfold Path. The fifth one is conscious livelihood. And this is an important one, I think, in our culture where we all have to make a living. We're not monks and nuns. We live in the world. We can't divorce how we make our living from our practice. It's too important. We spend a huge amount of our adult life working. So we can't sort of separate that like, well, I'm working, so this doesn't count. The Buddha was very explicit about what ways of making a living were definitely incorrect. You can see how all of these fall directly out of the five precepts. It's an interesting list. Trading in weapons and instruments of killing. Slavery. The production of meat and killing of animals. The manufacturing or selling of alcohol and drugs. Making or selling poisons. Any profession that involves deceit. That's quite a list. And when you think about it, that's a big part of our culture. These are all things that people make money at on a regular basis. And what he's really saying is, just don't go there. These are all harmful. And if we're trying to lead a conscious life, we have to try to lead a life that where we're not causing harm by how we make our living. The Buddha also said that the most conducive professions are teaching and farming. Well, first of all, we have to remember that this is 2,500 years ago in a very agrarian society in North India where pretty much everybody was farming. So it's a natural selection. In our culture today, we can't all be teachers or farmers. Though there's nothing wrong with being a teacher or a farmer. I mean, think about it. Teaching is like sharing knowledge, sharing wisdom with others. Very helpful to the world. And farming is like growing food. How can that be anything other than wholesome when you're As long, assuming you're doing it in a way that doesn't harm the environment, for instance, that doesn't violate the precepts. So, what we need to do in a broader context, how we can apply this conscious livelihood in a broader context to our lives and this time, is to see if we can approach whatever work we do with an attitude of service. Am I doing something useful for the world? And this doesn't mean we actually have to have an actual job, like in healthcare or social work, where we are directly of service. It means that we approach everything we do with an attitude of service and loving kindness. I had an interesting experience about this. It's 30 years ago now, probably more. Back in the days when I worked in the technological world, where I was a techie, I was a computer programmer, and I got this great job working for an automated mapping company. This was back in the 80s when automated mapping was still something rare. I got this great job on this project that was building an automated mapping system oriented towards mapping coastlines. And this was being done as a project for the Australian Navy. And it was just absolutely fascinating, interesting work. I really enjoyed it. It was difficult. I learned all kinds of new stuff. It was quite exciting, you know. And then I actually had to go to Australia to install this software and went to the Navy office. And I was just talking to one of the guys there, like, because I said, how come this is the Navy? Why isn't this at the Department of something else? Why is it that the Navy that's sponsoring this? And he says, oh, we really, you know, Australia has this huge long coastline. Most of it isn't mapped very accurately. And we really need to be able to map it and know where all the waters are where Russian submarines can hide. And it was like, oh. You know, it dawned on me at that right at that moment. It's like, oh, what have I done, basically? You know. I was just so fascinated by the work itself, and it was good pain, and it was interesting and exciting, that it never dawned on me that it might be actually put to a use that is less than wholesome. I actually quit that job about 6 weeks later. But it was like, we have to look at our life in that way. Like, is what I'm doing useful? Is it of service to the world? And there's lots of ways you can do that. At the same time, the Buddha never said it was wrong to be wealthy. It's all in how you make use of what you have. This is from a book called What the Buddha Taught by a man named Walpola Rahula. And he's talking about the Buddha talking to one of his disciples, and he's talking about what it means to be a layman and be happy. A layman, you know, someone who lives in the world. And he says, these are the four happinesses of the layman. The first happiness is to enjoy economic security or sufficient wealth acquired by just and righteous means. The second is spending that wealth liberally on himself, his family, his friends and relatives, and on meritorious deeds, on charity, on generosity. The third is to be free from debt. And the fourth happiness is to live a faultless and pure life without committing evil in thought, word, and deed, being virtuous. It's an interesting list. I mean, so it's okay to have money, it's okay to spend it and enjoy it. Nothing wrong with that. But the third one of these in our culture is kind of shocking, to be free from debt. It's like so counter to our culture. I mean, I remember talking to someone a while ago who was they just finished 4 years of university. He was $100,000 in debt. He didn't know how he was ever going to get out of debt. And that was just from going to school. Think of all the debt we are in for buying things or owning things. And I'm not saying we should never go into debt, but I'm saying it's something we have to be very conscious of in our culture, that we're not going into debt just to get stuff. And there's a fine balance we have to pay attention to there. The other interesting thing is, and this is once again from the book, it must be noted here that three of these kinds are economic, and that the Buddha finally reminded the banker that economic and material happiness is not worth 1/16th part of the spiritual happiness arising out of a faultless and good life. So the material things are important, but a virtuous life is way more important. So there's a lot to pay attention to here. To be on the path, to be following the teachings of the Buddha, we have to take everything we do and look at it to see if it's in accord with what the Buddha actually taught. It means that we have to actually examine our entire life and have it as best we can be in accord with how things should be. So I'm not saying this is at all ever going to be easy, but it is important. I want to finish with a little piece of a poem by one of my favorite poets, Mary Oliver. This is a section of a poem called I Happen to Be Standing. I know I can walk through the world, along the shores or under the trees, with my mind filled with things of little importance, in full self-attendance, a condition I can't really call being alive. To be alive is to not be caught in the world of self-attendance, of just taking care of what I want immediately right now. It's like taking the longer view, taking a wider view, and trying to fit everything into the context of leading a wholesome life. So that's what I have to say this evening. I'll finish with just a simple dedication of merit. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.